And so it's always zero sum. There's a scarcity mentality that there's not enough, and so groups are always struggling for each other over the spoils, build walls, erect barriers, think in conspiracies, think in apocalyptic terms, dog eat dog. And so that has been the culture that we are now in. And because people are just looking for community. I had a chance several months ago to spend an afternoon with Steve Bannon, and it was interesting. I enjoyed it actually quite a lot. It was like being with Trotsky in 1905. And he said, he was right up front, he said, you know, your form of community is too attenuated. People want to feel nation. Diversity is not a good thing, he said. And he had total belief in what he was thinking. He knew who his international allies are, Viktor Orban, Putin, Julian Assange, all these guys. And he felt he was on the march. And he's not that far wrong. In the 1990s, I worked in the Wall Street Journal and served abroad in Europe. And I covered all these great things. I covered the decline of the Soviet Union, the reunification of Germany, the Oslo peace process in the Middle East, Mandela coming out of prison, the end of apartheid, the Maastricht Treaty and the unification of Europe. And then at the end, I covered one little event that was just an annoyance to me at the time, which was the Yugoslav Civil War, if you remember the Bosnians and the Serbs fighting. And that event was the most important event I covered, because the ensuing 25 years have all been about ethnic tribalism and that kind of hatred and that kind of leader. For the past 20 or 20-odd years, according to Freedom House, the number of democracies has shrunk, not increased. The quality of democracies has deteriorated, not increased. What we thought was the triumph of liberal democracy and the end of history has gone away. And so to me, you know, George H.W. Bush, when he walked across the Yale yard on December 7th, 1941, he heard about Pearl Harbor, and he walked right into Elizabeth's office. And we don't have anything dramatic as Pearl Harbor, but when the foundations of democracy are being shredded, that seems to me it's a kind of silent Pearl Harbor. When truth and accuracy are being shredded, that seems to me a silent Pearl Harbor. When people are judged on their inherited characteristics and not on who they are, that seems to me a silent Pearl Harbor. When 55,000 people are dying of opiate addiction and 45,000 of suicide, it seems to me it's a moment that calls upon us to do more than we ordinarily do, to rebuild connection. And so I've spent a lot of time recently thinking, how do countries turn around? And how do they do it outside of war? And I used to joke it would be nice if Canada would invade us, because that would unify us. But now that might actually happen, so I can't see that. So there are a couple relevant examples historically of countries that turned themselves around. England between 1820 and 1848, and America between 1890 and 1910. And the one that happened here is germane. Around 1880, America was going through a lot of things it was going through now. A very individualistic culture, which in those days was called social Darwinism. Selfishness is fine. And then you had a lot of political corruption. You had huge waves of immigration. You had an economic transition to industrialization. A lot of things were the same. And there were the change came in three waves. The first was intellectual and theological. The social Darwinism was replaced by the social gospel movement, which said, we are actually all brothers and sisters together here. And so you had intellectual change and a religious revival that grew out of that. Second, you had a wave of civic institution building. Basically, a lot of people looked around all at once and said, you know, we've got all these great organizations to create young Americans of fine, upstanding behavior, but they were all built to raise kids in out in Abilene, Kansas. We've now got hundreds of kids in Chicago and Baltimore and New York who are immigrant kids who are not like, their conditions are nothing like that. What do we do with these people? And so within 5 years, they created the Boys and Girls Club Scouts, the Boys and Girls Clubs, the labor unions, the Settlement House Movement, the Environmental Movement, the Temperance Movement, the NAACP. All these organizations came into being quickly and scaled massively. And so the second was a civic movement. And then third, all the people in the civic movement eventually got together and said, you know, we're all engaged in the same project. We're adapting to industrialization. We're adapting to social breakdown. We're trying to create some unity and some decency. And then third, they became a political movement, the progressive movement, with Teddy Roosevelt and all that. So it was intellectual, civic, and then political, in that order. So what's going to happen now? Well, as someone who writes for the New York Times on the op-ed page and is sort of a public intellectual, it's not going to be led by people like me. The intellectual leadership is not there, and the credibility is not there. Intellectuals, I think, I believe in the power of ideas, but not in the short term. I don't see a religious revival coming, but we are in the middle of a civic revival. And hundreds of organizations are being formed in the last year, in the last 10 years, and some are of long-standing existence. And they tend to fall in a bunch of different buckets. There's a civic education bucket. How do we rediscover our national story? There's a social capital bucket. How do we rebuild communities, both bridging capital and bonding capital? There's a economic mobility bucket, which is how do we heal the economic divide? There's a racial bucket. How do we heal racial divides? There's a depolarization bucket. How do we get reds and blues together again? And then there's a meaning bucket. But there are hundreds of organizations out there all growing. And what one observes about these organizations is that, one, they're dispersed, and two, often they're more articulate, like me, about what they're against than what they're for and how to solve the problem. And to me, the most promising of these buckets is the social capital building bucket, the organizations that are actually reweaving social capital and healing the three core problems: the isolation, the alienation, and the lack of meaning. And my wife and I are part of a group that meets on Thursday nights, and there's a couple, a woman named Kathy, grew up in a big Catholic family, 9 kids. She's used to having a lot of people around the house. And she and her husband, David, had a kid in the DC public schools, and he had a friend named James who didn't have a place to stay. So they said, James can stay with us. And then James had a friend, and then James had a friend. And pretty soon there were 25 or 30 or 40 kids in their orbit. And there were mattresses all around the floor, kids staying in every room, and if you go to dinner, as we do on Thursdays, there are 35 or 40 kids. And some of them, sometimes it's the first dinner table they've been at in 10 years. And we were at Christmas over there last year, and one of the kids was given a present, this remarkably sophisticated photographer kid, and he didn't know how to open a Christmas present. It was like, do you untie the bow, or do you just cut it? What do you do? And so they provide community for this community of kids, and what the kids provide us is an intolerance of social distance. So I walked in there the first time, and I wanted to shake a kid's hand. This kid, Ed, and he said, we don't really shake hands here. We hug here. And so they're all hugging, and now I'm hugging. And I brought a friend of ours named Bill Milliken, who runs a group called Communities and Schools. And Milliken told the story that he's been doing youth work for 50 years, and he's often asked, what programs turn around lives? He says, I've been doing this half a century. I've never seen a program turn around a life. It's relationships that turn around lives. And so that organization is called AOK. And if you take AOK and make it about 10 times more sophisticated and about 100 times bigger, you get Sarah Heminger's group Threads, who we just learned about. And that, I would say, I've tried to meet a lot of people doing social capital. I've never met a group that has so far advanced in understanding how to do it, that has been through so many iterations. And what's happening here in Baltimore is just among the most exciting things I've seen in this field. And so all that is to say, the future is, and the answers are already out there. And we just have to learn from the people who have pieces of those answers. And one of the things they're doing is they're unsatisfied with organizations that are not relationally intense, where intimacy is not in the room. And we've all been through organizations that really touch us and organizations that don't touch us. And the organizations that touch us leave a mark and change us forever. You know if somebody's been in the Marine Corps, you know forever. You know if they went to Juilliard. You know if they were a New York Yankee. You know if they're a Morehouse man. There are certain organizations, they're just thick. And so I've been thinking a lot, what are thick organizations? They often have a physical location that's cramped that ensures a lot of physical contact. They often have shared tasks that involve closely watching each other. They often take retreats to an overnight place where they can see each other, where people can see each other after dinner and before they put makeup on in the morning, enforce some intimacy. They often have a sacred origin story or a near-death experience when the organization nearly failed. They usually have an idiosyncratic local culture. I go to a lot of colleges, and a lot of colleges are just like any other college. But some colleges are distinct, and they're not afraid to be themselves, and those are thick colleges. They often have a clearly defined goal, a sacred guidebook, sacred objects, a label. And these are the organizations that don't just serve you instrumentally, but transform who you are. And the people who can do that in a company or in a community group or anything, they are the ones who are changing people and rebuilding the social capital and ending the problem of isolation. And so I'm spending my time at the Aspen Institute in the afternoons, and we're trying to take all the people who are part of the answers and just meet as many as we can and lift them up and say, these are the people who somehow they have the answer. These are the people we need to learn from, need to be like. Second, we're trying to synthesize their ethos to figure out what they believe in common. I think there's a shared set of values that hasn't been quite articulated yet. And then we're trying to convene them to create a social movement. The things that change history, ideas do change history, politicians do change history, but if you really want to change history, create an attractive group of people doing good work that other people want to be like, and they'll bend their energies around it. That'll satisfy the needs of the heart and the soul. And so what I see is a whole group of people building promises, building institutions, and making commitments. And when you do that, it's amazing how quickly you can change a person and change a community. I was reading recently about a woman named Etty Hillesum. And Etty Hillesum, she's like a test example of how moral transformation happens, both in a community, but especially within an individual. And so she's sort of like this perfect experiment of how lives can be turned around. Etty Hillesum was born in Amsterdam in 1914, on January 15th, to a Jewish family. And she had two very unstable brothers and two parents who had sort of given up on life. She wrote in her diary, "I think my parents always felt out of their depth in life, and as it became more difficult, they were gradually overwhelmed and incapable of making up their mind about anything. So these three brilliant children were left sort of unformed to do whatever they wanted." And Etty's early diaries are incredibly sad to read. She keeps writing, "I'm a weakling, I'm a non-entity, I'm adrift, I'm tossed by waves." She feels fragmented, depressed, a mass of uncertainties, a lack of self-confidence, aversion, panic. She dreams that some man will come in and rescue her and give some coherence to a life that lacks all coherence. "What I really want is a man for life and to build something together with him and have all the adventures of a relationship, and unlike the ones that I've had so far, which have made me utterly miserable." When Etty was 26, the Nazis invaded Holland, and she's so self-absorbed, her diary entries barely record that fact. The occupation, it's as if it didn't happen. She's just obsessed with herself. She went to a therapist, a Jungian, named Julius Speer, and a combination of wise and creepy. He gave her good advice, but part of his therapy was to wrestle with his patients, physically wrestle with them. So she threw him on his back, and she actually felt that was one of the great turning points in her life. Wouldn't recommend it, but... And around the time he then died in 1942, and she changes after that. She said of him, "He was the one who attended at the birth of my soul." And you begin to see a shift in her diary about 1942. "Thinking gets you nowhere," she wrote. "It may be fine and noble in academic studies, but you can't think your way out of emotional difficulties. That takes something altogether different. You have to make yourself passive. Just listen. reestablish contact with a slice of eternity. Some of you may have read Parker Palmer, Listen to Your Life. Nietzsche has a phrase, if you ever find out, want to know who you are, list the four moments you were most joyous and draw a line through them. And so it's just a being receptive. Eugene Peterson says that we're taught to think in two modes. There's the active voice, which is I'm taking control. There's the passive voice, which is somebody else has taken control of me. But Peterson says there's something called the middle voice, which is the voice of conversation and response. And that's a voice that's learned. One day, Hillison was sitting on the sun in her family's stone terrace, and she was gazing at a chestnut tree while listening to the birds. Her first instinct was to write a little paragraph about how beautiful the tree was. And then she decided, no, I'm just going to stop, and I'm going to listen to this moment. She said, in other words, I wanted to subject nature and everything to myself. I felt obliged to interpret it. But the quite simple fact was that now I just let it happen to me. I sat like that in the sun. I bowed my head unconsciously as if to take in more of life. Suddenly, I knew deep down how someone can sink impetuously to his knees and find peace there, his face hidden, folded in his hands. And so at that moment, she began to think about prayer. And she began to pray, and she called herself a kneeler in training because she wasn't very good at it. And you wouldn't say she was religious in any formal sense, but she did say sometimes in moments of deep gratitude, kneeling down becomes an overwhelming urge. When I write these things, I still feel a little ashamed, as if I were writing about the most intimate of intimate matters. In prayer, she wrote, it is no longer, I want this or I want that, but life is great and good and fascinating and eternal. And so she slowly became a different person. And the first thing she noticed was she was living in occupied Holland, and she began to see what was happening around her, actually sooner than a lot of her neighbors. She wrote, the threat grows ever greater from the Nazis, and the terror increases day by day. I drew a prayer around me like a dark protective wall, withdraw inside it as one might to a convent cell. She wrote, they are out to destroy us completely. We must accept that and go on forever. And so the first instinct was to escape, and 25 Dutch Jews did try to escape, and 18,000 of them survived. Anne Frank was actually a rarity. But she didn't want to escape because she didn't want to live in fear. And by then, she had felt a calling, a vocation, which was to serve her whole people. Her biographer says that she decided not to escape. First was her sense of solidarity. She belonged to her people. She belonged to her community. And she didn't want to give up her community. She had felt a sense of commitment, a vocation to serve those around her. So she volunteered to go work at a place called Westerbork. Westerbork was a camp when they shipped Jews from Amsterdam and they were going to ship them east to the concentration camps. They stopped at Westerbork, and sometimes they could stop for months or years before they got finally shipped east. She volunteered to go work there. And so she worked at the camp. And she said, it is just as if everything that happens here and still happens were somehow discounted inside. Now I'm helping to build a new and different society. She felt if she could love the people as they were passing through, she could answer hatred and love and build a new society. There are many miracles in human life, she wrote. My own is one long series of sequence of miracles. The misery here is quite terrible. And yet late at night when the day has slunk away into the depths behind me, I often walk with the spring in my step along the barbed wire. I can't help it, that's just the way it is, like some elementary force, the feeling that life is glorious and magnificent and that one day we shall be building a whole new world. And if you flip back, if you're on page like 300 of her diaries and you flip back to page 50, you can't believe you're seeing the same human being. Through this commitment to community and the building of relationship, she has been utterly transformed. And there are scenes of her in the camps. She's got two babies in one arm, and she's consoling an old lady at the same time. She went from hospital ward to hospital ward, consoling the baby. And then in 1943, every day a train would leave the camp taking those away who were to die. And there would be a list released about who was to go on the train. And then one day in 1943, her name was on the list. And she was, for an hour, struck. But then she recovered, apparently, And someone who survived said that she spent the afternoon talking gaily, smiling, a kind word for everyone she met on the way, full of sparkling good humor, perhaps a touch of sadness, but every inch the Eddie you all know so well. She was put inside a car with her family, and on the way to Poland, I guess, she wrote it on a postcard, and she just threw it out of the crack of the car window, and a farmer found it and sent it. And she writes to her friend Christine, "Opening the Bible at random, I find this. The Lord is my high tower. I'm sitting on my rucksack in the middle of the full freight car. Father, mother, and Misha are a few cars away. We left the camp singing." And she was killed. But you see someone who's found through community and through community service an inner hardening. And I think that is what I started with, the heart and soul, and I'll finish just with that. That what the heart and soul yearn for most of all is that sense of connection with each other in pursuit of something good. And I have a little collection at home of quotes about joy. And when people experience the high moments of their life, the moments of joy, those are moments of moving in unison in pursuit of the good. And so one of the quotes is from a guy, Rabbi Wolf Kellman, who marched with King at Selma. He wrote of that experience, "We felt connected in song to the transcendental, the ineffable. We felt triumph and celebration. We felt that things change for the good and nothing is congealed forever. That was the warmest, most transcendental spiritual experience. Meaning and purpose and mission were beyond exact words. Meaning was the feeling, the song, the moment of overwhelming spiritual fulfillment." And if you go through all these hundreds of descriptions of joy that I have, you find one thing recurs in almost all of them. The sense of losing awareness of where your skin ends. That you feel merged with other things. And the poet David White captured it. "Joy is a meeting place of deep intentionality and of self-forgetting, the bodily alchemy of what lies inside in communion with what formerly seemed outside but now is neither. Dance, laughter, affection, skin touching skin, singing in the car, music in the kitchen, the quiet, irreplaceable, and companionable presence of a daughter, the sheer intoxicating beauty of a world inhabited as an edge between what was previously thought was us and what we thought was other than us." So to me, this deep yearning we all have inside for this fusion, for this connection, is the cause for ultimate optimism. Because we may be isolated, but we will invent a culture that solves the problem of our current moment the way all our predecessors solved the problem of their moment. And we'll figure out a culture that's more communal, that's more relational, and we'll move up a step. Thank you.